Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's June 9th, 2016, 9th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin shared this 14-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 6, Registered Funds, Considerations for Alternative Investment Managers. Timothy Levin and Sean Graber will discuss the major considerations for alternative managers going into the registered funds distribution channel. Now, on to the podcast.
This is the Registered Funds Panel Considerations for Alternative Investment Managers. I'm Tim Levin. I'm joined today by Sean Graber. Sean and I both spend a lot of our time practicing in the hedge funds area, but spend probably an equal amount of our time representing registered investment companies and advisors to registered investment companies, and so have been spending a lot of time over the last few years assisting really managers that are primarily in the alternative space with thinking about if and how to get into the registered funds area. And so with a little bit of background on that, maybe the easiest thing to start off with is just very quickly we'll run through some of the types of registered funds that we're talking about.
So we'll start with open-end funds. Open-end generally means that you have a right to get out of the fund on your own terms, and that's where the term redeemable shares comes from. Mutual funds, ETFs, both offer redeemable shares, so you have a statutory right to redeem on demand. So mutual funds are basically preparing for an unknown amount of redemptions on a daily basis. Buys and sells coming into the fund, which requires a calculation of a net asset value every day. So therefore, we have valuation concerns in mutual funds regarding whether you can price your securities on a daily basis. And given that you have to have the ability to redeem people on a daily basis, the SEC does impose a 15% limit on illiquid investments. The definition of illiquid investments generally ties to a 7-day right to liquidate. And that ties, again, to the fact that mutual funds have 7 days to pay their investors 100% of their redemption proceeds, generally in cash, but there could be some instances where there is redemptions in kind. ETFs are a little bit different than mutual funds in the sense that they are issuing and redeeming their shares in basically large creation units with large financial intermediaries, generally, you know, above 250,000 shares at a time, where they are basically selling their shares to intermediaries who would give them blocks of securities. So that structure is actually very tax efficient for both the shareholder and the funds. And these shares are going to be traded on the exchange. So instead of a mutual fund where you're buying and selling shares as of 4 p.m. every day, you know, exchange traded funds allow shareholders to come in and out on a daily basis. And therefore, some of the exchange traded funds are actually, you know, designed for that type of market in, market out type movement. The one other aspect for ETFs that people always should keep in mind is the fact that, you know, there is a SEC exemptive order process in order to launch ETFs. So that always needs to be factored into the timeline and the cost when getting into the ETF business.
And then similarly, you've got to look at the exchange, the rules of the exchanges where the ETF will be traded, and depending upon whether you've got a novel product or can fit within some model exchange listing standards, that's another possible negotiation that you need to factor into the timeline.
Exactly. Now, to create a mutual fund, I would say from scratch, it's, you know, from the SEC process, it's probably close to 120 days. Depending on how novel your product is on the ETF side, it could be a year, possibly two. So there's obviously a little bit of a timing consideration there as well.
So then the next, we just talked about the open-end funds. The other major category of registered funds are closed-end funds. And the first one is what we call the listed closed-end fund, which I think is probably what people are most familiar with seeing. And listed closed-end funds issue permanent equity. Now, that's obviously something that a lot of managers like, but it comes with some trade-offs in the structuring. The way that this type of listed closed-end fund works is there's essentially an underwritten IPO where the fund goes out and makes an offering of shares and raises a certain amount of capital. The shares then trade on the exchange, which is how the investors get their liquidity. So whatever capital was raised, the shareholder activity on the exchange doesn't affect the amount of the fund's capital base. The issue with this, though, is that once you've done the IPO, it's a relatively inflexible vehicle for raising additional capital. And so what you'll see oftentimes is that if you're going to do closed-end funds, you'll see managers that are heavily into the closed-end fund business will sort of be in the serial closed-end fund business, meaning that they'll do many, many different products on an ongoing basis, because that's really the way that you can grow capital.
Yeah. And this is the space where you see the activist investors come in to the listed closed-end funds because of the trading value, market value, versus the actual net asset value of the underlying holdings. You'll see the activist investors come in and try to replace board members, either to have these closed-end funds do tender offers or repurchases to shore up the difference between the market value and the net asset value, and in some events actually turn a closed-end fund into an open-end fund in order to open up the NAV to shareholders.
All right. Then the other subtype of closed-end funds is the unlisted closed-end funds, and this is a type of product where we've seen a lot of interest from alternatives managers. It's a closed-end fund, which means, in contrast to the open-end funds, there's no right of redemption at the option of the shareholder. So these shares are non-redeemable, but these shares may be continuously offered. And so this type of closed-end fund can make a continuous offering. Usually we'll see something either monthly or quarterly for openings. And then liquidity is provided through periodic tender offers or repurchase offers. There's a technical distinction that we're not going to get into here between funds that are technically interval funds under certain rules that have been adopted under the Investment Company Act, as opposed to funds that merely do a tender offer for their shares. But practically speaking, they're quite similar in terms of overall product design. And what we usually see is that these types of funds will conduct quarterly tender offers or have quarterly opportunities for liquidity, but that's not necessarily a requirement. And so we do see funds like this that have lockup periods associated with them or might have less frequent liquidity openings.
Yeah, and I would say that the liquid alternatives boom of a few years ago happened in the open-end space, the mutual funds, the ETFs, whereas the liquid alternative light boom is actually happening in this unlisted closed-end fund space with the proliferation of interval funds now and just general closed-end tender offer funds. Yeah. And just because it's more of a hybrid approach where you actually, as the manager, can control the right of redemption, it gives you that level of flexibility to put more of your assets to work in illiquid investments.
This type of fund also can be done in a public offering or a private offering and has the flexibility to be taxed as a partnership, which means that it will give investors K-1s, or to be taxed as a regulated investment company under Subchapter M, which means that it is treated as a form of corporation that has pass-through treatment and can give investors 1099s. Sean, why don't you talk a little bit about some of the shareholder advantages for the registered fund structure?
Sure. The registered, the shareholder generally wants access to non-traditional asset classes, but considering the amount of money they're looking to invest, have been generally shut out of that type of asset class. So mutual funds and ETFs are basically filling that need. We have now commodity-based funds, you have real estate funds, real asset funds, MLPs, all of these areas a mutual fund shareholder can access, with a generally $1,000 minimum investment. So from a shareholder's perspective, that is, obviously something if you want to diversify your own portfolio and able to do that with a broad diversification. As Tim had mentioned, registered investment companies generally are taxed as regulated investment companies under the code, which is a certain type of corporation that does not get taxed like a public corporation. And one of the key characteristics there is the pass-through of the tax character on the distributions, where the fund shareholders basically get the same tax character that the mutual fund gets with respect to long-term, short-term capital gains.
Right.
And that is obviously a lot better than the distribution from a general corporation where everything is taken out a 30% or 35% haircut.
Well, and this becomes an important consideration when you look at the distribution channels in which these types of products usually are sold, where more frequently we see that the manager's plan is to sell the fund through a network of financial intermediaries, very often through the registered investment advisor space or through some of the larger broker-dealer financial intermediaries. where this distinction of getting a 1099 versus a K-1 is very important because you're dealing with sort of a sophisticated retail investor, but not somebody who typically wants to receive a K-1. So it's generally viewed very favorably by the financial intermediaries and by their clients when these types of funds can issue 1099s.
So I would say they just touch upon the other aspects of funds that shareholders really like is the enhanced transparency, that is the SEC overlay of these products. You know, generally, it's a quarterly portfolio holdings, but I would say it's industry practice for shareholders these days to go to their fund website and get a top 10 holding report, if not more, on a daily or weekly basis. The SEC protections regarding liquidity, and you have the board governance structure. The chief compliance officer oversight, all these things provide comfort to shareholders when they're looking to look at the risk of their investments and sort of making sure that there's somebody in the boardroom looking out for them.
So just why don't we focus a little bit on some of the manager advantages as well. Obviously, distribution is a key feature. The registered funds can be sold to an unlimited number of investors, can be sold through multiple distribution channels, and can really involve a lesser degree of client, manager-client involvement than the typical private fund structure does. And so that is an advantage, I think, that managers see in the registered fund space. It does mean that you're usually partnering with people for distribution. That's even more important, perhaps, in the registered fund space. But the scope of the opportunity is viewed as favorable in the registered funds. The other thing that is, I think, often viewed as good from the manager's perspective is that the registered fund, because of the distribution, because of the board oversight, the CCO, the way that the service provider platforms work in the registered fund space, particularly if you're talking about turnkey fund platforms, which are very popular in a way for alternatives managers to access the registered funds market, it really allows the manager to focus on managing the money, and a lot of the other aspects of the product management can be outsourced to service providers or intermediaries. The other thing that's very important in this that's related here, although it's not listed on the slide, is that the registered funds are not themselves plan assets. And so in terms of your distribution opportunities, you can go and sell the registered fund to all manner of retirement plan investors without the fund itself becoming, without the fund's assets being treated as plan assets. So the registered funds themselves will not be plan assets, and that's generally something that, as you'll hear in a later panel today, the DOL rules and the ERISA rules affect the distribution side of it, but not the management, the internal management of the fund. So what are some of the key, it's not all positive, what are some of the key registered fund regulations that you need to be aware of when going in this space?
You know, we called a list of the maybe the top 10 questions, so to speak, we get from our alternative manager clients looking to get into the registered fund space. One of the questions we always ask is, okay, what type of transparency do I need to give to my investors? Am I disclosing the secret sauce? How often do I need to tell them exactly what I'm doing? So there are some fairly stringent rules in the registered space about public disclosure of holdings. Right now, the frequency is quarterly with full disclosure of portfolio investments. As I mentioned earlier, I would say the practice nowadays is actually, you know, top 10 holdings or more on a monthly basis posted to a website periodically. The SEC has proposed rules to completely revamp investment company disclosures to the SEC in addition to investors, where they're actually going down to monthly portfolio holdings, and they are expanding the type of information that needs to be given. Instead of getting a schedule of investments, you're actually going to get information on derivatives use in the fund, securities lending in the fund, the amount of leverage and risk characteristics of the fund. So these are obviously rules that are greatly impacting registered fund investors and have, you know, are dipping into the areas that alternative managers like to keep, you know, behind closed doors. Yep. And the other one we always talk about is advisory fee limitations. And, you know, I think the easiest answer we always give to that, if you waive your advisory fee for one, you are waiving it for all in the registered space. There are very strict rules regarding capital structure under the Investment Company Act. And one of the basic tenets is the advisory fee must be charged equally across the board. And then we also have limits regarding distribution. There is, obviously, if you're reading any SEC pronouncements in the past couple months,
There is a very big push these days regarding how distribution fees are paid out of investment companies. You know, there's a particular rule under an Investment Company Act called Rule 12b-1 that governs the distribution costs that funds can pay, and the current sweep of the SEC is really this practice that they're referring to as distribution in guise, where mutual funds and their sponsors are having fund assets pay for what we, or the funds, are characterizing as non-distribution services, but the SEC has questioned whether some of those are actually distribution services.
On the fee topic, as you can see here on the slide, it says, you know, performance fees may be charged if all fund investors are qualified clients. As a practical matter, though, we see relatively few funds in the marketplace that are registered funds and limit investment to qualified clients. It's much more often that we see alternative strategies being offered with a traditional mutual fund type of compensation to the manager, which would just be straight basis points. And so a product development consideration for managers oftentimes is reconciling how you're going to describe the differences in the investment strategy where you're charging just a straight management fee versus, and how you articulate that versus the investment strategy in the private fund where the manager's getting two and 20 or whatever for managing in vaguely the same style. So product differentiation is an important consideration. Mm-hmm. Quickly, I think Sean mentioned some of the restrictions on the use of leverage. This is an area where I'd say actually in reducing the use of leverage, there's an SEC rule proposal out there right now that at least has the potential to radically change the rules around use of leverage for registered funds. So we'll have to see how that plays out in the final rules. But we do think that the SEC is going to adopt those rules in some form. Hopefully they've been receptive to the hundreds of industry comments on this topic. A couple of other sort of basic regulatory requirements that apply to funds there. And then
the big one there is collateral for derivatives and leveraged transactions. There are very strict rules under the Investment Company Act about where collateral and fund assets can be kept. There is a lot of trip-ups in the liquid alternative space regarding whether you're posting collateral to a prime broker. That, in fact, can only happen under very specific circumstances. Generally speaking, collateral needs to be kept with the fund's custodian and pledged to the counterparty through a tri-party custody agreement. So that is one significant structural change that we usually go through ad nauseum, I think, in the product development stage.
Yeah. And Sean, you want to talk quickly about the board and advisory contract requirements?
Sure. Everybody's favorite topic is board oversight. The 40 Act does require, at least now, an independent board. The SEC has, in past years, tried to raise the requirement from majority to 75%. That was overturned. In the same proposal, they also tried to have all mutual funds have an independent chairman. That also was overturned. But it is the fact that it's very customary for mutual fund boards, ETF boards, to have a lead independent trustee, which is somebody who is, you know, participating on conference calls, agenda items. So this is something that always needs to be kept into account, because you're going to have an overseeing body that, if it's your own fund, you can select, and you'll need to review their qualifications and experience to make sure that they understand your product development, what you're trying to achieve, and make sure that they buy into that structure, but also are competent enough to understand what you're telling them so they are able to oversee the operations. And then the last thing I'll touch on the slide is the advisory contracts and Section 36B. Section 36B is really the only private right of action under the 40 Act and imposes on a fund advisor a fiduciary duty with respect to its compensation. Not only that compensation that goes to the advisor, but also to the advisor's affiliates. And there has been a tremendous uptick in 36B litigation over the past couple of years that's been really focused on investment advisors and their fee splits with the sub-advisors that they hire. I can't say that's really been narrowly tailored to the liquid alternative space. It's more of just a overall trend that is going on, but it's really something that new advisors to the space have to think about when they're setting their advisory fees and the types of information that they're going to need to give to the board in order to have the board do a conscientious review and approval of those fees.
And this last slide here, a few things: valuation, compliance programs, chief compliance officers, and transaction with affiliates. I think my only comment on this slide is that these are issues that have been front and center in the registered funds area, really, as long as the Investment Company Act has been in existence since 1940. These are things that historically might have been different from the perspective of a private fund or hedge fund manager, but in past years, as we've talked about in other panels, these are all areas that are subjects of such critical focus for the SEC in the alternative hedge fund space that what I would say is that really what you're used to and think of as best practices in the private fund area have probably come up to a level just about where they meet and intersect with the registered fund space. So what might have been a disincentive to get into the registered funds area on any of these metrics probably isn't so terribly different from what the alternatives managers are dealing with today.
Yeah.
And then lastly, in our slides, we don't intend to go through these, but we do have a chart that, as you can see, it goes through several slides and compares the characteristics of hedge funds, closed-end interval funds, and then the alternative liquid alts mutual funds. Thank you.
To listen to other panels from the 2016 9th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius, LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.